Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. My name is Matthew Martin. I'm counsel for Plaintiff Appellant Maurice Hardaway. There are two issues that I would like to discuss with the Court today. The first being that Pearson v. Callahan, the Supreme Court's opinion in 2009, strongly suggests that the Court below should have begun by undertaking the issue of whether or not there was, in fact, a liberty interest before proceeding to the second prong of the qualified immunity issue of whether or not that interest was clearly established.
Why is that, since the whole point of Pearson was to restore the discretion that the district courts used to have to decide which of the two qualified immunity inquiries to take up first? I mean, under Saussure, we had a very clear mandate from the court, and the court said, gee, that's really not such a good idea. Sometimes it's just so much more straightforward to look at the clearly established question that we're going to say that the district judges can make that decision. Why isn't that what happened here, and why isn't it entirely acceptable?
The Pearson Court noted that there are certain specific situations in which Saussure remains the preferred approach, and one of those situations is directly at issue in this case, which is you can't adequately understand whether the liberty interest is clearly established without first understanding whether it exists to begin with. Now, the Seventh Circuit has consistently held that in order to understand whether a liberty interest in avoiding disciplinary confinement exists, you look at the conditions of that confinement and compare them to other conditions of confinement, for example, conditions of administrative confinement at the same facility. You take that comparison and you juxtapose it with other comparisons in prior cases, and then and only then can you understand whether or not the liberty interest was clearly established.
But here, I mean, what the district court does do, and of course the magistrate judge doesn't really even have qualified immunity in the case yet. He just puts a little placeholder, nobody's filed a motion, he says, and so this comes up before the district court. But the district court judge looks at the conditions, looks at the fact that it's the solid metal door, that he's got some mental health issues, that there's very little opportunity to get out of the cell, to shower, to exercise once a week. And the district judge says, well, maybe I would find clearly established at one end or the other end of the spectrum of conditions, but this is such a gray area that it's one of those areas where you just have to find qualified immunity.
I would disagree with the district court's analysis so far as, again, it's not just looking at one set of conditions. You have to compare in order to understand whether or not the conditions are atypical and significant relative to the ordinary conditions of the prison environment.
What do you think you'd find if you took a look at Menard and you looked at their administrative segregation, you looked at the general population cells? And how much of a difference under Wilkinson, under Sandin, under any case, do you think would need to none of this happens, of course, but would need to show up in the record?
I think that we would have to understand, for example, how often it's the case that, as the court noted in Lakis v. Brilley, this court in 2005, if Mr. Hardaway was placed with a fellow prisoner who had violent tendencies, a violent past, especially if he was placed with that individual in a relatively small cell, that was
That does happen with some, from time to time, even in the general population at significant prisons like it's a high security prison.
Well, what we're asking here is for an adequate opportunity to provide, to develop some sort of factual record, which the magistrate judge explicitly noted just hasn't occurred here. And if you look at the court's opinion also in Whitlock v. Boglino, they said at the summary judgment stage, there simply isn't enough information about the conditions of confinement in order to grant the defendant's motion for summary judgment at that stage.
So your best argument then is that we have only one half of the equation. We know from what he describes what his conditions were. I forgot to throw in the black eyes, but we know what his conditions are. And you are asserting anyway that with discovery you might be able to see that his conditions are so much worse than other conditions, whether it's other comparable prisons in Illinois or whether it's other units at Menard. I realize there's a little bit of uncertainty in the law about that, but somehow you think you might be able to show that he had enough of a of a reduction in his conditions to count as a liberty deprivation.
That's correct, Your Honor. We are looking at just narrowly tailored fact development at the district court level, for example, serving some interrogatories on the defendants, as well as a potential Rule 45 subpoena on Menar to understand what the conditions of administrative confinement were between September 2009 March 2010, and also some very limited discovery in terms of what any sort of history of violence that his former cellmate may have had immediately before being placed with Mr. Hardaway.
That almost sounds like an Eighth Amendment claim to me. I mean, it's a little different from the due process claim that you're asserting. Because if they had deliberately put him in a cell with somebody who was going to beat him up or do other violence on him, that comes up normally as an Eighth Amendment claim.
Yes, Your Honor, but we still think that this is principally a liberty interest issue, and when you look at Marion v. Columbia Correctional Institute, when you look at Lakis, when you look at the dozen or so cases that the court looked at in understanding whether or not a liberty interest exists, we're principally looking at comparing those conditions, and nowhere in those opinions did Eighth Amendment considerations come up.
But is a comparison necessary if the conditions that the plaintiff describes are really not bad enough to implicate a liberty interest anyway? Let's suppose it's two showers a week, not one. There are a ton of cases that talk about two showers a week being enough to live by, even if it might not be anyone's preference. So he has one shower a week. He's with this cellmate. He's got the solid door. Do we know for sure that just without the comparison is so bad as to implicate a liberty interest? We don't think the other people are in a country club, right? Not at Menard. I can assure you they're not.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, I do think that there are cases, for example, a series of cases in the Second Circuit, Colin v. Howard, as well as Parker decision, where there are the conditions of disciplinary confinement are exactly the same, if not significantly better, in that instead of one shower, 1 hour of yard time per week, an individual had 1 hour each individual day. And the court in Collin compared those conditions to the conditions of the general population and said, yes, there is a liberty interest here in avoiding disciplinary confinement. Admittedly, that Collin decision involved disciplinary confinement of 305 days. Here we only have 182 days. But still, we think based on that line of cases, as well as Wilkinson v. Austin, obviously that was indefinite confinement. But still, when we're looking just at the conditions of confinement, we do think that there's a trend in the case law, although there isn't a case in the Seventh Circuit that's clearly on all fours with this case. And we also believe that turning to the issue of due process, that Mr. Hardaway was not adequately provided due process prior to his liberty interests being deprived. And so there are two specific issues that came with regard to that issue. The first being that he was provided no meaningful opportunity to present testimony in his self-defense.
Testimony or anything else, is that
exactly? So it doesn't have to be oral testimony. It can be written testimony prior to the hearing. He was provided no meaningful opportunity to do that. The cases both in the Seventh Circuit and the Supreme Court clearly say that informal, non-adversarial proceedings to which Mr. Hardaway was entitled, nevertheless require that there be some notice of the charges against the prisoner, as well as a meaningful opportunity to present defense. And that clearly did not happen here.
You're focusing on both of those, the lack of adequate notice and the lack of an opportunity to respond?
Yes, we are. We think that the second issue in terms of lack of opportunity to respond is the more glaring problem, but we also believe that he wasn't provided adequate notice. Now, we believe that the notice that's required under kind of the relaxed and formal due process requirements here is nevertheless coextensive with what the Illinois Administrative Code requires, which is simply date and time that the alleged violations occurred, if that's reasonably possible, as well as the location where that happened. Here we have no information whatsoever in the disciplinary ticket or anything afterwards in the record indicating the precise date or time or approximate date or time where this happened. In addition, while we understand that these alleged violations were said to have occurred in a general facility. It doesn't list what floor. It doesn't note whether it's in an adjacent yard. Without this sort of opportunity, without this sort of notice, Mr. Hardaway didn't have a meaningful opportunity to marshal facts in his own defense to be able to provide the disciplinary review board information that would have quickly dispatched of this issue, which the Administrative Review Board on appeal noted specifically halfway through Mr. Hardaway's 182 days in confinement. The Administrative Review Board said, you guys need to take a second look at this. That did not happen, and we believe that that was in violation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. Mr. Siegel.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, Counsel. I'm Assistant Attorney General Evan Siegel on behalf of Charles Purnell and Brett Meyerhoff. Your Honors, affirmance is appropriate here regardless of the fact that the District Court assumed, without delving into whether Hardaway had a liberty interest in avoiding 6 months in segregation at Menard. As Judge Wood noted, the Court wasn't required to address that first Pearson question about liberty interest. Pearson answers the point that counsel raises himself. It's a doctrine of judicial convenience. It does not confer a right on a party to have a question answered in a particular order, and it certainly doesn't mandate a remand for additional fact-finding.
But what is troublesome about this is before we know what is or isn't clearly established, we need to know something about the facts of his case. And what troubles me is this idea of having only half the equation, because we don't know if there's an atypical and severe hardship until we know how this condition, you know, of course, once you get over the qualified immunity point, this is a troublesome case because this guy serves his entire 182 days when he probably shouldn't have served a single day. But we'll put that to one side. Focus on qualified immunity. If this is that much worse, then a liberty interest exists, and we don't have any facts. We're sitting around sort of guessing what's it like in the rest of Menard. Most of us have seen Menard cases before. We know it's not so great, but we don't know how to look at this.
Well, this Court's decision in Marion versus Radke, which is the Marion 2 case, answers that question, and it compels affirmance for my clients. In that case, which involved a pro se prisoner at a Wisconsin high security facility, the case came up twice to this Court. In the second case, which was on summary judgment, the record was bereft of any information about just what you're talking about, Judge Wood, the information about the baseline, and also implicitly information about, in the appellate decision at least, the conditions of confinement. And that omission was fatal under Marion II, because the obligation to come up with a set of facts to counter a defendant's motion for summary judgment doesn't rest with the defendants, it rests with the plaintiff, even a pro se one, as in Marion II. Where the Court held that the plaintiff's status as an inmate didn't change his burden to marshal evidence in prison to show the conditions of his confinement differed significantly from the comparative baseline.
Well, but Marion also says this is very fact-based, and what constitutes a substantial length of time is a factual issue, unusually harsh, a factual issue. He does, our plaintiff here, Mr. Hardaway, does show why his conditions, especially the mental stress. I mean, maybe other people could be put in this same area at Menard without it being a problem, but he calls to the attention, files grievances, he sees the mental health counselor. I think he does have facts about why for him it is significantly different from what he came from. We know that.
Well, a couple of responses on the emotional harm point that you raised, Your Honor. The record shows that when Hardaway went into disciplinary seg in about September of 2009. He immediately went to mental health services. He complained that he had anxiety. By October, within a few weeks, he wasn't showing any signs of that mental condition or that anxiety. Now, there is a distinction between Marion 2 and this case that is worth noting. There was counsel below in the district court for a brief period of time, not Mr. Martin and his colleagues, when the attorney who represented Mr. Hardaway very well could have asked for discovery to be reopened, could have had his client submit an affidavit.
How long? When you say a short time, what do you mean?
Right around the period that the magistrate judge was considering the case.
No, but like weeks,
two months.
2 months.
I think May to late June of 2012, I believe. And nothing was done. And Mr. Hardaway himself, who better than Mr. Hardaway than to write a short affidavit explaining
what conditions elsewhere in Menard where he doesn't live are?
No. Comparing the general population, if that's the measure, and a number of this court's cases hold that the general population, as opposed to segregation, is that baseline. He could have compared his situation in segregation to the general population.
Well, he sort of is, isn't he? He's saying, you know, the one shower a week. He's saying the solid metal door.
That's the one half of the equation. That's what we know that he experienced. We don't know what the baseline is.
Well, but he's implying that that's different from what he was experiencing before he went to disciplinary seg. You said he should describe what his general living environment was.
He's implying it, but he hasn't established it with evidence. And that very gap in the record accounts for why the district court couldn't assess the extent, the contours of the liberty interest.
Well, that's the problem. You know, that's why I wonder why it's appropriate with this much factual inquiry hanging to say there's nothing clearly established. Maybe it's very clearly established that there's no problem because there's just no difference between the two situations. Maybe it's clearly established that this is a huge reduction in the quality of his life. I don't know. I could imagine either answer. And so how do I know what's clearly established as a matter of law?
Well, it might well be. But as you suggested earlier, Your Honor, what are we going to find if we look at Menard or if we look at another facility? And again, this court has suggested that you can look at the general population elsewhere. You look at administrative segregation. We know from half a dozen or so of this court's decisions in cases such as Lacoste and Williams and Whitford that the experience that Mr. Hardaway had with the shower, the cell door, cellmate, etc., do not rise to a constitutional violation under either due process or the Eighth Amendment. Now, just getting back to Marion II for a moment, the exact same situation obtained there. There was nothing on the record twice in Marion I, dismissed under 12b-6, or on summary judgment about the conditions at all. And there was no warrant for a remand. The prisoner there had his bite at the apple, and that was it. The defendants won on summary judgment. Now, a counsel appears to be making implicitly in his reply brief an argument that Hardaway should have been appointed counsel below to help him, I guess, write an affidavit or whatever evidence he was going to put on. But that argument about appointed counsel under Pruitt versus Moat was not raised below, was not raised in his opening brief, and so it's been forfeited. The second line of attack that Hardaway makes is that he wasn't warned by the district court with a specific directive that he should have developed the record. The summary judgment itself is the warning, and there's no different treatment for pro se cases.
Oh, there is different treatment. They get a specific warning. You know, this is the process. You give them, I mean, the district judges do that all the time.
Well, there's no local rule in this district about a specific warning, but there are plenty of cases in this court where pro se prisoners didn't marshal enough evidence, and plaintiffs with lawyers, of course, and they didn't create a sufficient factual record to question.
Well, not creating the record and not knowing you need to create a record are two different things. There are plenty of actual lawyers who also don't create enough of a record.
True. But knowing what we know about Hardaway's conditions, this court could, if it were so inclined, address the first prong of Pearson without any evidentiary remand, because we have the baseline for what happens in other Illinois and Wisconsin and Indiana prisons. And nothing that Mr. Hardaway experienced was triggered a constitutional violation. Just briefly on Whitford and the Second Circuit case that counsel mentioned, Whitford was right on the eve of Sandin. It was remanded. We don't know what information was there about. There was no information about the baseline or the subjective conditions. It involved a six-month term in segregation. And there
that's
the court.
That's true here, too, right?
Correct.
180 days.
Correct.
So,
of course.
182.
Yes. And 6 months and a day. Of course, there's no approach in this circuit that the duration itself it draws the bright line.
Although this is long on a duration. We have a lot of cases that say 90 mm-hmm. is probably not, out of bounds.
Despite the remand in Whitford, the court said that 6 months is not so much. So I see that my light is up. If there are no further questions, Your Honors, we will stand on our brief and ask that you affirm the district court. Thank you.
Mr. Martin's time expired. It had, but you may have an additional minute, Mr. Martin.
There are several issues that I would like to provide just a little bit of additional clarification on. The first being that, contrary to opposing counsel's statement, Mr. Hardaway not only experienced anxiety throughout his disciplinary confinement, but noted that. So, for example, both in October and November of 2009, he told his mental health officer that he was experiencing problems. In January of 2010, he was diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder. In terms of counsel below, he was denied counsel on two separate occasions, and when he was provided counsel, that was more than 5 months after the briefing for summary judgment had ended. With regard to Williams and Ramos being similar cases in terms of the conditions of confinement, as this court noted just a minute ago, those cases were 70 days of disciplinary confinement or even less. So we think that with the holistic analysis that this court has continually required, not just the conditions of confinement but the length, that they're easily distinguishable on that front. In terms of Marion II, this court, albeit at the motion to dismiss stage, instructed the lower court to take an additional look, but in fact, it told the court to do so, noting explicitly what conditions of confinement the prisoner needed to provide facts on. And when the prisoner was not able to do so after that court's explicit instruction, that's when this court on appeal said summary judgment would not be would be provided. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. Thank you, Mr. Siegel. The case is taken under advisement. That case being Hardaway versus